Let's begin here. If you watch the video is long, but it gives you, I think it's going to cover this material as well, but I'll move along kind of fast, so I'll try to get caught up. The idea is we're talking about UV visible absorption. I talked about theoretical things, theoretical considerations, pi to pi star transitions, n to pi star transitions, what gives rise to the absorption measurements, and that's what we talked about. That was what was on the video. It talks about organic molecules and the structure of the organic molecule, and of course conjugation, pi systems, and therefore you get, if you have pi electrons, and you can have pi to pi star transitions, sigma to sigma star, all those kinds of things. It talks about charge transfer absorption, inorganic molecules, ligand field absorption, all those types of absorptions. You need to know those things in order to determine, if somebody gives you a compound and says, can you do a UV visible absorption spectrum for this compound? Well, if it's a long chain alkane, it's not going to do you any good. You're wasting your time. There's not going to be absorption, because in a long chain alkane, you know, like dodecane or something like that, there's only sigma bonds, okay, and therefore sigma electrons. And if you look in the notes, you'll find that there's a low probability that you're going to be able to see a sigma to sigma star transition. There are no pi electrons. You can't get a pi to pi star transition. There are no non-bonded electrons, electrons, because there are no heteroatoms. So you need to be able to assess whether a molecule will absorb or not absorb based on its structure and some of those theoretical considerations. So I talked all about that. I even talked about inorganic things, which involves charge transfer in the ligand field, and you know, why are solutions of copper and nickel and iron and all those different metals, why are they colored? Well, they're colored solutions because of charge transfer absorption, or excuse me, ligand field absorption, and because they have d electrons that have partially filled, and so there can be transitions from one d orbital to another. So those are all important for UV visible absorption theory. Okay, theory, a theoretical reason of why, what gives rise to the particular transition. Now I'm getting into here, in this slide, application, okay, applying UV-Vis. How can you use it? What's it good for? Well, number one, Roman numeral one, listed here, is for qualitative information. So I want to know what the compound is, or where it absorbed, and then I can tell something about what the molecule is by where it absorbs. So if it absorbs at 300 nanometers, it probably has an aromatic ring in it. Okay, benzene absorbs around 295, 300 nanometers. Salicylic acid, benzene ring with a carboxylic acid and a phenolic group on it, absorbs around 300 nanometers. So you get some idea, but it's not like IR, where IR has a fingerprint region with very narrow bands and many bands that will give you an absolute identification. You cannot go to court with a UV visible spectrum and say, I have absolute proof that this is the compound. No, a lot of things are going to absorb at 300 nanometers. So when you go to do qualitative analysis, you want to do a spectrum. You want to measure the spectrum, so it talks about that here. You want to measure the molar absorptivities, which is, of course, related to the amount of absorbance you get. And you want to measure the wavelength at which you get those absorbances. And that may give you some qualitative information. It may give you some information about what the compound is. Certainly, if I give you two molecules, okay, if I gave you, I just mentioned salicylic acid, okay, with a benzene ring, if I gave you that molecule and asked you to compare that or to differentiate that molecule from a compound like we looked at spectra for anthracene polyaromatics with multiple aromatic rings, they have a very different spectrum. Okay, those two compounds. So I could, you could tell the difference between the two of them qualitatively by running a spectrum and find out that the salicylic acid absorbs at 300 nanometers and gives you just one broad band. The anthracene absorbs at shorter wavelengths and longer wavelengths and gives you multiple bands, and so you'd be able to tell the difference based on the spectrum. So we're going to do UV visible absorption. We need if we're going to do qualitative analysis, we need a spectrum, okay? And we're going to be interested in the wavelengths and molar absorptivities, and that's what's on the slide show or the movie that I left for you to watch while I was away. That has that theoretical. It talks about the different transitions and what wavelengths they occur at. Okay, now it's good to have a double beam instrument. We talked about double beam versus single beam, but the single beam with a computer interface will give you the same information. We'll allow you to get the entire spectrum. Not as good as IR. I wouldn't go to court with it. Okay. Now, quantitative, this is where the strength of UV visible absorption is. Okay, the strength of UV visible absorption is quantitative analysis. Beer's law, right? A is equal to epsilon BC. What does it say here? It says that there's large values of the molar absorptivity. So what's B is typically one, B is usually equal to 1 centimeter or 10 millimeters. Right. So whatever the path length is, we're stuck with that. I have a 5 centimeter. I might have brought it in. Right? Maybe I didn't. Yeah, 5 centimeter cell. Okay. So you get a little extra sensitivity. I've even seen 10 centimeter cells for liquid solutions in UV visible absorption. But generally speaking, this is fixed. Okay. B is fixed. So A, the absorbance, tells me something about concentration, but the molar absorptivity, epsilon, is the proportionality constant between concentration and absorbance. If I have a big molar absorptivity, I'm going to have better sensitivity. I'm going to be able to measure lower concentrations because I have a big proportionality constant between the absorbance and the concentration. So UV visible absorption is good for quantitative analysis because there are large values for the molar absorptivity. The molar absorptivity for pi to pi star transitions tends to be 10,000, 50,000, okay, for this molar absorptivity value. That's going to mean good sensitivity. Many compounds, number two here, many compounds absorb organic compounds, whereas the solvents don't. So hexane, water, methanol, ethanol, chlorinated solvents you want to use. A lot of those solvents give you a big, broad, transparent region where there's not any absorbance. Some of them will absorb way down at 200 nanometers and, 205, methanol absorbs down there and some of these other compounds. But generally speaking, big, broad range of no absorbance. So now we've got solvents that I can use in my cuvette and dissolve my sample in, and they don't absorb. But the solute molecules, many organic molecules, do absorb. So perfect situation for UV visible absorbance measurements. IR, that's not the case. Water absorbs in the IR. Okay, all solvents, hexane, all those things absorb in the IR region. So I can't use them as solvents. I can't make a cuvette and fill it with some solvent and put it in the IR instrument. It's going to absorb. So now, then I get stuck with the absorbance of the solvent plus the absorbance of sample, and I got to subtract out the absorbance of the solvent. And when you subtract out things like that, it sometimes alters the spectrum a little bit. You subtract out a little bit more in one place and a little bit less in another place, and all of a sudden you created a feature. You created a peak in your spectrum. So that causes artifacts that alter your spectrum. So IR is not as simple as UV visible for making these quantitative measurements. So we've got large molar absorptivities, many compounds absorb, many common solvents do not absorb. All right. The absorbance bands in the UV visible region are very broad. big broad band. Remember the problem in Beer's Law that if I have a peak, okay, I want to be right here on the top of the peak. I don't want to be on the side of the peak, because on the side, the molar absorptivity, okay, is changing. Right? On the side of the peak, the molar absorptivity is changing. If I'm a nanometer off one way or the other because of I dialed in the wrong wavelength, my monochromator was not calibrated properly, and I set it to 300 and it's really at 305, the band pass of the instrument is very broad, and I'm not getting just this little spot here, but I'm getting a broad band of radiation. All those things are problems if I'm on the side of the peak. Well, it's not a big deal in UV visible absorption, because the bands are broad, so I can find the top of the peak real easy. Now, think of an IR spectrum. It's got all these really narrow bands. Sitting on the top of one of those bands could be a little bit tricky. I could be, if I'm a nanometer or two off, I'm off on the side of the band. So UV visible absorption has these broad bands, very easy to find the wavelength of maximum absorbance and be able to sit right on that and make a good quantitative analysis. So we avoid those deviations from Beer's Law. And the number four here is good instrumentation available. Good sources, good detectors, monochromators. We talked all about those kinds of things. And Roman numeral one, we can do qualitative analysis by UV visible absorbance, but it's not great. It's not going to give us positive identification. It's going to just give us some confirming information. We have to use it with other techniques. We have to have other information. Roman numeral two, we can do good quantitative analysis. This is the real strength of UV visible absorbance. I can do quantitative analysis. I can measure the concentration of species and get good quantitative information. Roman numeral three, I can do all sorts of other types of studies with UV visible absorbance that involve chemical processes. I can take my little cuvette and I can do a chemical reaction right in the cuvette. I can do I can measure kinetics. I can measure binding of a protein to a substrate, of a metal, to a ligand. I can do all sorts of chemical things in the cuvette, and I will be able to monitor the chemical process. So this is not quantitative, not qualitative, but this is studying a process. Okay, so that's what we're talking about here. It usually involves conversion of a non-absorber to an absorber, or the other way around. I make something absorb by reacting it. I make something non-absorbent by reacting it. Okay, and I can measure that change in absorbance. Spectrophotometric titrations are one example of a chemical process that you can measure. So here I'm going to take the sample and I'm going to titrate it with something and come up with a product. And the example is permanganate plus iron 2 is going to give me manganese dioxide and then an iron 3. So I'm oxidizing the iron 2 to iron 3. The manganese is being reduced from whatever this is, manganese 7. This has a plus 7 valence, and here it's a plus 4. So I'm going from a 7 to a 4. I'm reducing the manganese. I'm oxidizing the iron. Now, it turns out iron 2 absorbs. Now, permanganate absorbs too. They both absorb. But in my example, I'm just going to use the iron 2 absorbance. If you go back to the video, you'll find that it's a ligand field absorbance. Iron 2 has a ligand field absorbance. It's a yellow-colored solution. All right? Actually, I'm sorry. Iron 3 is yellow. Iron 2 is blue. Okay? And so I do a little experiment, and I measure absorbance versus the volume of titrant added. So here's my little titration curve that I'm going to do. I'm going to titrate away, and I'm going to get some data. Now, in my experiment, the iron is the titrant, and so in the beginning, what do I have? Well, let's say I have, we'll call that zero, okay? I have no iron added, so there's no absorbance. If I'm measuring the absorbance of iron 2, which I said is blue, then a blue-green kind of a color, then I pick out the wavelength, whatever wavelength that is, and I monitor the system and I titrate away, adding iron 2 solution to permanganate. Initially, I add iron, and it immediately reacts and gives me iron 3 and manganese dioxide. I have no iron 2 left. It's all gone. It gets immediately consumed as I add it to the solution. My absorbence stays low, okay? It stays down around zero. After a while, I add enough iron to consume all of the permanganate. The permanganate gets used up, okay? And now my iron 2 concentration begins to increase, and I begin to see a increase in the absorbance. So I get this classic shape of the absorbance curve when I go from when I'm titrating with an absorbing substance that's being consumed, and then after the end point, after I've used up all of the permanganate in this case, I begin to see the iron absorbance. So I get a curve like this. If I analyze that curve by drawing a line through it and extrapolating, you know, the end points here, or the extrapolating to find the end point, okay, I drop a line down and I say, okay, there's the end point of my titration. Okay, right here is where there's an exact stoichiometric amount. If it's one iron per one permanganate, this is where it comes out. Or if it's 1 to 2 or whatever the reaction might be. Now, in this case, I just told you it was how many electrons? 4. There were 3 electrons. This was +7. This is +4. This is only a 1 electron transfer to go from iron 2 to iron 3. It's losing 1 electron. The permanganate's gaining 3 electrons. So there's some stoichiometry in there. It's not 1-to-1. The end point, okay, right here. And the fact that this point here does not lie on the little extrapolated lines means that the reaction is incomplete at the end point. It doesn't go, in the case of it's either kinetically hindered or by the equilibrium constant. Okay, the equilibrium constant is small or is not large enough to give me a complete 100% reaction at the end point. Okay, you can do spectrophotometric titrations for all kinds of systems. Here are examples of systems where in Roman numeral A, the first panel here, excuse me, not Roman numeral, letter A, if I have the molar absorptivity of the sample is equal to the molar absorptivity of the product, which is equal to zero. So neither the sample nor the product absorb, but the titrant absorbs. Okay, that's the example we just saw. If you have that case, you get this shape of a curve. All right. What if I have a different situation? Well, here in panel B, the product has a molar absorptivity greater than zero. The product absorbs, but the sample and the titrant don't absorb. Neither one of them absorb, but the product absorbs. As I add titrant and it reacts with sample, I create product and I get an increase in the absorbance. And then when I consume all of the sample, I can keep adding product all day long. The absorbance just levels off. Okay? So you understand, it matters whether it's the titrant that absorbs, the sample that absorbs, or the product that absorbs. All right? What if none of them absorb? You're out of business. You can't do anything. Okay? They may absorb at different wavelengths. Right? So you need to understand all of these possibilities. Okay? Understand this. I'll put it on the exam. Okay? That's the only way I get you guys to do anything. So it's going to be on the exam. All right? Okay, so these are typical curves. Another example of something you can do is you can study an equilibrium. I mentioned this a minute ago. If I have a metal and it reacts with some ligand, so what's a good one? Iron 2 reacts with 1,10-phenanthrolene. 1,10-phenanthrolene is like a three offset rings with a nitrogen. I can't remember exactly, but it's got it's a specific iron 2 reagent. It only binds with iron 2. So, why don't I use the example I have on the slide? That's one example of a metal plus a ligand yielding a metal complex. The example I have here is iron plus thiocyanate. Again, this is a charge transfer absorption. What's a charge transfer absorption? I'm not going to tell you. You have to go watch the video. Okay, but a charge transfer absorption occurs in a system like this. This is a two-component system, so it's a intermolecular charge transfer. It's between two molecules. You can have intramolecular charge transfer in compounds like aniline, just a rearrangement of the electrons in one molecule. But here we got two. So we got iron 3 reacts with thiocyanate. The thiocyanate transfers an electron. The little electron goes over here, okay, and we end up with a 2 plus charge. You say, well, that's just the overall charge, 3 plus 1 minus. In a charge transfer situation, the actual charge is transferred. In other words, the electron moves from the thiocyanate to the iron atom or ion and creates iron 2. And so it's iron 2 that becomes the new species. But anyway, you go back and review that. So it's a metal plus some ligand gives me a complex. Okay, there's an equilibrium constant for this reaction, a K value. Okay, there's also a stoichiometry. Is it 1:1, 2:1? Well, this graph tells you that it's 1:1. I can do a what we'd refer to as a mole ratio. I don't know if I have. Okay, reactants do not absorb. Products do absorb. We get this type of a curve, which is basically shown to you on the previous slide, right? This type of curve. Reactants don't absorb. Okay, so you get that one. At the as I increase the amount of, and what I'm doing is I'm plotting absorbance versus different ratios of the ligand to the metal. So what do? I go into the laboratory, I make up a solution of iron 3, I make up a solution of thiocyanate, okay, and I mix the two together in various ratios. And now I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 solutions. Each dot represents a solution. So I mix them in different ratios, and I plot a graph of absorbance versus the different ratios, and I take each solution and I measure it in my instrument. Solution number 1, okay, has this absorbance. Solution number 2 has this absorbance. Okay, it has a greater ratio of more ligand to metal, and I get a plot that looks like this. Since I know the ratios of the metal and the ligand and what their molar ratio, everything's done with moles, right? A mole reacts with a mole, or sometimes two moles react with a mole. Okay, but we do it in a mole ratio method, and when I plot it this way, it falls. The break in the curve, the extrapolated break in the curve, falls right over 1. That means it's a 1:1 reaction. 1 mole of iron 3 reacts with 1 mole of thiocyanate. This is a mole ratio study. It's a way for you to determine the stoichiometry, the way in which these compounds react together. Okay? So this is a study of the equilibrium. Now, in my lab, and no one's doing this work in my lab right now, but for years I did experiments like this and develop data treatments to fit the curve and determine the K value, right? There's a K. If this is the reaction, then there's the product, FeSCN2+, over the reactants. Iron 3 and the thiocyanate. Okay? And so that equilibrium constant is representative of the ability of these things to react to form the product. The bigger the K, the more the reaction lies to the right, the more product you get. If the K is small, it doesn't. I have a lot of reactants left over and not much product. Okay. By the way, a small K value gives you a broad curve like this. A high K value gives you a very sharp break in the curve. Right? But we can study that equilibrium with this kind of a system. Okay. Hold M constant, increase L, make different ratios. Okay. Okay, so here's the calculation. I can calculate the molar absorptivity from A at excess L. So out here, right? Essentially, OM is reacted to ML, and as excess L is added, and since this is the thing that absorbs, then I can determine out here what the molar absorptivity is because I know the concentrations I've added. I know B. I measure A, and now I can determine the molar absorptivity, right? Down in here, I don't know how much of this complex I have. Okay, all I know is the absorbance, and I know they're reacting to some extent, but I don't know what's going on. But once I determine the molar absorptivity at every absorbance value, I can calculate the concentration of the complex. Right? So that's what this is all about. I calculate the molar absorptivity out at the end of the curve. I get the number of the stoichiometry, 1 to 1, 1 to 2, whatever, from the break in the curve. Okay, and I calculate an equilibrium constant using the equation I gave you and mass balance expressions. If you don't know how to do that, take chemical oceanography, right? Next semester, chemical oceanography, and we do calculating equilibrium constants, right? It's a bad, just a bad memory. Okay. This type of a plot, the mole ratio, is a what's called a Jobs. There's Jobs method of continuous. There's all different methods. Okay, and all it is plotting the same things in a different way. Sometimes you know the concentration of the metal and the concentration of ligand, and you know their molar concentrations, and you can mix them together in different mole ratios. Sometimes you don't know. Sometimes a lot of the work that I did was with natural products, natural compounds that we didn't know the concentration of. We would go out into the environment, get a sample, and not know what the concentration was, but we could still do a study. Even though we didn't know, we knew that we were adding metal to the system and binding, causing a complex to be formed and causing a change in the photochemistry of the system, and be able to measure that and determine from our data treatments what the concentrations were, what the stoichiometry was, those kinds of things. All right. So this is just types of things that you can do with UV visible absorption to understand chemical systems. I mentioned earlier studying kinetics. I take two things, X and Y, I add them together, I get Z. Z absorbs, I get a curve like this. Okay? What's the time frame? It depends on the kinetics. It might be millisecond time frame. If you're going to do millisecond time frame experiments, if you're going to do things that react on the millisecond time scale, then you are going to have an instrument that is set up to do some kind of a stopped flow kinetics, where you flow two streams together and they mix, and you're able to, within fractions of a second, measure the absorbance of the curve. And again, how do things react? They're going to react by some exponential law, whether it's first order kinetics, right? Second order kinetics, pseudo first order kinetics. We can do different types of experiments monitoring the change in absorbance versus time to determine what the rate constants are for the kinetic procedure. All right, and so that's what this is all about. Okay, I'm trying to move fast because this information's on the website for you to listen to, and you were supposed to listen to it while I was gone. Okay, errors in photometric analysis. There are a lot of errors. There are a lot of possible errors. This is an area where I am concerned that, you know, people who aren't analytical chemists, who don't understand, who haven't taken my course, go and make measurements in the laboratory and they mess it up. They totally mess up the measurement because they don't understand the principle. They just think, well, you stick the sample in the instrument, it gives you the right answer. It gives you an answer, it must be the right answer. Okay. We already talked about Beer's Law and what we call deviations from Beer's Law, chemical or instrumental deviations. What's a chemical? A chemical deviation would be where you get, remember I said dimer formation? Or I'm measuring absorbance and the compound reacts and forms something else and I don't have what I thought I had. There's a chemical reaction occurring. I mix two things together and they form a complex. And the complex absorbs, but at really high concentration, it precipitates out and doesn't absorb anymore. Well, okay, so it's a chemical deviation. Instrumental deviations have to do with monochromatic radiation, broad bands, using round cells instead of square cells. All those things are screw-ups, okay? Things that people do wrong, okay, when they are making measurements. It says here that many of the deviation problems can be solved by just doing a good calibration curve, right? So you do absorbance versus concentration, and you do many data points, okay? And I've seen people do absorbance versus concentration, and it's not a straight line. They use it anyway. Okay. Now, sometimes you can get away with that if you've calibrated properly, and you have data at all the areas where you're going to make measurements. It might be okay to use a curved calibration curve. But normally you want a straight line, okay? Calibration curve includes standards higher and lower than what your sample is. So I want what's called bracketing the sample. The sample's in the middle, and I got to know the behavior of the system at lower concentration and higher concentration. So I bracket the sample and measure all across the range which I'm measuring. You can't run some standards. Standard 1, standard 2, standard 3. Then measure your sample and it's out here. Well, you don't know what happens after this much of the curve. You know, it could go, right? Your calibration curve is not defined beyond your last standard. So you want to be you want to have a situation where the standards, okay, and your sample is in the middle, okay, and so you get a nice well-defined situation. Technique errors, okay, you got to clean the cuvette, right? What if the cuvette's got lint on it, a fingerprint on it, dirt in it, scratches? Sample left over from the previous sample that you put in there. A lot of people will soak their cuvettes. They do a lot of work. You put them in concentrated nitric acid. What will that do? They burn about anything off of the glass or quartz. Don't put plastic in there. Well, some plastics, but not all. Will stay. Most plastics will degrade under high acid concentration. If it's glass or quartz, acid will not hurt it. Okay, concentrated acid, it comes in a glass bottle, right? Acid doesn't hurt the glass. So, but it'll burn off or oxidize any any sample left over from other, you know, analysis, fingerprint oils, things like that will get removed. Okay. Says here, rinse it several times with water to rinse out the nitric acid, of course. Then rinse with the sample. If you don't, if there's a little bit of water in your cuvette left over from your rinse, when you put your sample in there, you dilute your sample with a few drops of water. Oh, that's not much? Each drop is 50 microliters, okay, approximately. So if you have three or four drops in there, you have 0.2 milliliters, okay? 0.2 milliliters in a 2-milliliter sample is 10%. I just introduced a 10% error into my experiment by leaving a few drops of water in the cuvette from the previous, from just rinsing it. So I got to rinse it out with my sample in order to make sure that I don't have a dilution effect like that. These are technique errors, things people don't think about, and it messes up their results. I mentioned already round cells. Even when you're using square cells, you should always put the cell in the same way. How do you know? Well, on the side of the cell, it usually has a little marking, like a, sometimes there'll be a letter. G for glass, Q for quartz. Okay, you want that marking always to be positioned the same way, say, in the direction of the source. So I put the cuvette in the same way. I'm not going to be getting artifacts in my results due to imperfections in the glass. Okay, any differences that occur from one turning the cuvette one way or the other. Okay, you got to make sure your system is warmed up. The source drifts in the first 20 minutes, half hour. Allow it to warm up. Make sure you check your 0 and 100% transmittance readings frequently. That would be, some instruments have a push button auto zero kind of a thing or whatever. But you got to do that frequently, otherwise it'll drift off of zero and you'll have an error introduced into your readings. We talked about stray radiation from a instrument point of view. Now let's get quantitative about it. Okay, light, extra light getting to the detector that didn't go through your sample. Well, if this is Beer's law the way it really is supposed to be, A is equal to the log of I0 over I, and I've got some extra light in there, which would be stray light, okay, then that's going to be added to both the source intensity, I0, and the transmitted intensity, I. So I make an equation, and I put IS in both the top and the bottom, okay? You can, any instrument that you have, any UV visible instrument, will have a stray light specification. Okay, here's two numbers from two instruments. Stray light is equal to, and this says less than, 10 to the minus 6th times the source intensity. That's good. In a spectronic 505, it's only 10 to the minus 3rd. The carry 14 was, they don't make them anymore, a very highly, very high precision, high accuracy research grade instrument. The spectronic 505 is an inexpensive, you know, student model instrument that doesn't have the high stray light. Remember what the carry 14 had, the double monochromator in it. Remember I told you ways of reducing stray light? One of them was to use a double monochromator. Okay, that's why it's 10 to the minus 6th. Very high number. Very, I guess it's a low number. Very low number. Okay. Now, if you take the number and you're doing absorbance, high absorbance value readings, I used actually an absorbance of 2, then this is what happens. If the absorbance is 2, then it's 100 over 1 for I0 over I, because 100 over 1, the log of that is 2. If I add into it a little bit of stray light, okay, what do I get? I get an error. Instead of getting 2.00, I get 1.96. And that is a, that's using this stray light specification, 10 to the minus 3rd. So straight light makes a difference, particularly at high absorbance values. Something to be considerate of, something to be concerned about. Oh, here's the calculation down here. Whoops. There's my stray light. There's the absorbance value. Make sure you know how to do that calculation. Make sure you understand that. Reading error is another error. I look at the value on the screen. What do I do? Well, if I do what's called biasing the result. Okay, I worked for Bristol Myers when I was in college in a pharmaceutical lab, quality control, and they would bring you a sample in, and they would tell you find out if this meets specifications. Well, what are the specifications? Well, there's a spec sheet. Specifications tells you it's supposed to have a certain absorbance, a certain concentration, a certain whatever, certain pH. If it didn't pass the test, if it didn't meet specifications, then you tell the lab manager, he'd say, run it again. So you run it again, and if it didn't meet specifications, he'd say, run it again. Okay? And now why? Why did he do that? Well, in some cases, there was a truckload of material out on the loading dock waiting to be unloaded. Sometimes it was a train. The train cars would come right into the plant and unload chemicals. And if it didn't meet specifications, they'd have to reject and send the whole train load of stuff back to the manufacturer. Okay? So, biasing the result is the manager, the lab manager, the boss says it's supposed to be 0.02 absorbance. Now keep doing it until you get the right answer. Okay, well that's not the way you're supposed to do things. But so what do? I put the sample in the instrument and I turn it on and I see some numbers and I write down the number I like. Okay, I don't wait till it gives me a steady reading. I don't wait till it's equilibrated and gives me the actual true value. I take down, the numbers are flashing on the screen, there's a little bit of drift or noise or whatever, and I write down the number I like. Because if I get the right number, I get to go home, you know. I don't have to work late. I don't miss lunch today. I get to go to take a break. So, people do this all the time. They don't allow the instrument to stabilize, and they take the reading before it's ready. They assume that the precision or accuracy is better, like they take, I mentioned this when we talked electrochemistry. pH measurements, 0.01 is good. The buffers are only plus or minus 0.01. So why bother with measuring 0.000 after the decimal place, three places after the decimal place with a pH meter, when the buffers are only good to two places after the decimal? The same is true with absorbance readings. Okay, biasing the results. The question is, are these two readings different from one another? Well, you know from your notes. Because of this, plus or minus 0.02, this could be, if you add 0.02 to this, it gives you 0.021. If you subtract it, it's 0.017. Okay? Well, this is 0.021, so these two numbers are the same within that precision. Okay? Okay, so no, there's no difference between them. What if the standard deviation, whoops, I skipped. What if the standard deviation were this? What if it was 0.19, oops, I'm sorry. 0.019 plus or minus 0.001. and 0.021 plus or minus 0.001. Are those two numbers the same or different? What's that? You think they're different? Okay. So if I add 0.019 plus 0.001, I get 2.0. If I subtract 0.0, I subtract this from here, I get 2-0. So within the standard deviation, those two numbers are the same. I can't tell the difference between them. Okay? So this is biasing the result. I want it to be different, or I don't want it to be different. I just make it up. Okay? You got to be realistic. People get into trouble doing this kind of stuff. Right? Okay, you can do what's called scale expansion. It's not done a lot today, but in a typical absorbance measurements, we either go from 0% transmittance to 100% transmittance. Okay, so 100% T, 0% T. Okay. That's normally what we do. Or you start out with some absorbance value and so forth. Transmittance and absorbance can be converted one to the other. To scale expand would be to, it's like going to a higher sensitivity. Instead of calibrating the instrument and zeroing it and setting the 0 and 100% value, I expand the scale by setting it the high end to 50% T. So I go from 0 to 50. Now I have expanded the scale, and I can get better. Often, the instrument is capable of giving me better precision than what I would normally just measure in 0 to 100%. So I expand the scale, and I'm able to get better sensitivity. Okay, and it's used sometimes. It comes in handy at times. So read about scale expansion. Okay. There is a limit to scale expansion. There's a certain amount of intrinsic noise in the instrument. Okay. All right. One of my favorite topics is luminescence. And luminescence is defined, as it is here, light emission accompanied by a transition from a higher to a lower energy level. So, what did we do before? When we talked about absorption, we said light is absorbed, and an electron is promoted to an upper level, okay? That's the absorption process. That's what we've been talking about. Absorbance, absorbance, absorbance. Now we're changing it. Now we're going to look at the excited state electron going back down to the ground state and giving off light. That's an emission process, not an absorption process, but an emission. It requires absorption first, okay, or some way to get the electron to the excited state. But then it goes down to the ground state and gives off radiation, and it's called luminescence. Okay, light is emitted. If the excited state is generated by a photon, absorbance of a photon, and they get excited state, it's called photoluminescence. Okay, photoluminescence. There are two kinds of photoluminescence. In other words, I generate the excited state by a photon, by absorbing light with a photon, and then I watch the emission process. There's two kinds of emission processes that come from a photon being absorbed. Those two kinds of emission processes are fluorescence and phosphorescence, and they're listed here for you, okay? There's a difference between fluorescence and phosphorescence. As a chemist, you ought to understand the difference between the two, because the rest of the world doesn't know anything. Okay, they don't know anything about chemistry. They think it's all the same. They're so confused that they call these fluorescent lights, and it's not even fluorescence that's coming out of these lights. Okay, it's phosphorescence. Right. So excited state generated by photon often exhibited by solids. Okay, so phosphorescence, okay, is often exhibited by a solid. I brought some. When I talked to the undergraduates about this. Okay. I ask them, does anybody have anything that glows in the dark? And this is what they come up with. They take these little, they buy these in the store, and they glue these to the ceiling of their dorm room. Okay. And then when they turn the lights off, the little stars glow. Okay. Don't tell me. If you have these at home, don't admit it. Okay. So, you hold this up to a light, right, a bright light, and you shut the lights off, and it glows for a while, and then it stops. Sometimes you have a keychain that has a little glow-in-the-dark kind of a thing, right? Okay, you can look at the stars if you want. So, That is phosphorescence. Okay. The on the back of a CRT screen. Does anybody? Do you know what CRT stands for? See, this is one of these things.
Cathode
ray tube. Okay. See, half the world doesn't know what CRT means. Okay. It's a cathode ray tube, right? So this big tube, big giant vacuum tube. On the back side of the screen are phosphors, things like lanthanum and europium and terbium, rare earth elements that are put on the back of a television screen or of a CRT screen, and then there's a gun. It comes out of a science fiction movie, a cathode ray. The deadly cathode ray. What is a cathode ray? What comes from a cathode? Electrons. Electrons come from a cathode. A cathode ray is just an electron beam. It's just electrons. A cathode ray gun is a gun that shoots electrons. So the gun shoots across the back. It scans across the back of the screen, and as the electrons hit those phosphors, they glow, and that's how you get pictures on a TV set. Okay, if it's color pictures, it's got all those rare earth, lanthanide elements back there that are giving you red, green, and blue, and so you get different colors. If when it hits the red phosphor, you get a red dot. Okay, those compounds phosphoresce. Okay, they give off phosphorescence. The calcium fluoride the white stuff that's inside of these tubes is excited by the mercury vapor lamp, right? It's a mercury discharge, gas discharge lamp we talked about. But mercury gives off most of its light in the UV. That doesn't do us any good, right? Unless you want, they have black lights, UV lights in nightclubs or something, or something like that. Well, the same light without the white stuff in it. Okay, a black light, those purple colored lights, those are same exact mercury lamp, but they don't have any phosphor in them, and they have a quartz tube, so you get UV light coming out. They use them to grow plants with, they use them to disinfect things, right? UV light disinfects. In a dental office, they put the tools underneath a UV light to sterilize them. Burns the UV light, burns off the bacteria, kills the bacteria. So in these lights, they paint the inside of the tube with a white powder, calcium fluoride. Calcium fluoride phosphoresces. It's excited by the mercury lamp in the UV, transfers its energy to the visible so we can see. Okay, but they're not fluorescent, they're phosphorescent. Okay, now I'll explain to you later why it's phosphorescence and not fluorescence. There's a different process. Photophysics. There's a photophysics. We know, we understand the photophysics, and there's a difference between phosphorescence and fluorescence, and I'll explain that to you later, but you need to know that. Fluorescence is a photoluminescence, same kind of a process, excited the same way, still get the excited state, but now it's found in solutions. Okay, you can do fluorescence. I have a fluorescence instrument in my laboratory. You can make measurements of fluorescence. And quinine. Okay, you know quinine? Quinine in tonic water. Go to the grocery store, buy tonic water. Okay? Tonic water, if you hold it up to the light, sometimes I bring it in to class. If you hold it up to the light, it'll have sort of a purple haze to it, a glow. What is that? That's the quinine sulfate. Usually it's quinine sulfate. Phosphorescence, and the history of quinine. The British were going around the world, conquering the world, right? And they went to places where there was malaria, and quinine was a cure. It's a symptoms of malaria. So the British were putting it in their gin and tonics, right? Only mad dogs and Englishmen are out in the noonday sun drinking their gin and tonics. And the quinine was help the symptoms of the malaria. So that's why quinine is in tonic water today. It adds a little bit of a taste to it, I guess. But that's an example of fluorescence. Light excites the quinine, and it gives off fluorescence. Solution phase, not solid state like the star or like the phosphor that's inside there. It's a solution phase situation. Okay. There's more luminescence. Okay. There's bioluminescence. Right. Enzymatic process. You know, fireflies. Right. When I was a kid, we called them lightning bugs. Okay. We used to catch them and put them in a jar. Okay, then they die. Okay, but that's an enzymatic process. Firefly luciferase, you can buy it from a chemical supply house. And it's an ACE, it's an enzyme. So firefly luciferase gives off that green glow, right? And so you can people use it in the laboratory. I'll explain that in a minute. But it's not bioluminescence anymore. Why? Because we killed the firefly in order to get the firefly luciferase, right? But enzymatic process. In the ocean, there are some fish that have luminescent bacteria in their eyes, in their eye sockets. Yeah. Way down deep in the ocean where there's no light, there's fish that have headlights. Yeah, they got headlights. They got beam, high beam, low beam, you know. And what is it? It's a symbiotic relationship between the bacteria and the fish. They've got a little pocket under their eye that has a luminescent bacteria living in there. And they're able to see in the dark, deep depths of the ocean. I don't make this stuff up. This is real, okay? I used to work at the New England Aquarium. My first job out of graduate school was working in the research laboratory at the New England Aquarium doing environmental research. But we'd go down and look at all the fish, and they had fish with luminescent bacteria. Some algae glow. So sometimes you'll go, my wife and I were on Cape Cod one time, and the tide had come in and made tidal pools along the beach. And then the water goes out, and the tidal pool, the water was slowly draining out of the tidal pool. In the tidal pool during the day, algae would grow. As it was draining out slowly through a narrow channel, you would see flashes of light at night. It's just a luminescent bacteria. Bacteria that gives off bioluminescence. The excited state is created biologically, not by a photon. There was no light, no photons going in. This was at night, and they're flashing light because the energy comes from a biological process. So, that's bioluminescence. Now, chemists, forget bioluminescence because we're going to kill everything before we analyze it or before we look at it. So, the minute we kill it, all right, it becomes chemiluminescence. If we make it luminesce, it's a chemical process. It's no longer caused by a biological process. So I can take firefly luciferase and use it on some substrate, right? It's an ACE, so it's an enzyme. It's a catalyst. And I can use it to catalyze oxidation reactions of peroxide and things like that. And it'll glow. But if I do it in a test tube with no living organisms, it's chemiluminescence. Right? I killed the firefly, and now I'm doing chemiluminescence. So the excited state is induced chemically. All right, I brought what did I bring? I hope I brought. I brought the light stick. You know the light sticks? You open them up and you break the thing and it glows in the dark. Okay. It's made by American Cyanamid. Well, it's actually made by a British company. Omniglow, but it says right in here, where does it say it? They have a license from American Cyanamid. Cyalum. Manufactured and distributed by Omniglow. Made in USA. Cyalum is a trademark of the American Cyanamid Company, which is in Stamford, Connecticut. Okay. After I got out of graduate school, they offered me a job, but I didn't want to make these. Okay, so what's inside of there? It's a plastic tube. It's got a solvent. You can go to the Journal of Chemical Education and learn how to make these. It's a phthalate. The solvent is a phthalate, very viscous compound. There's a reason they use a viscous compound, because luminescence is deactivated by collisions. Right? If a molecule has energy and it collides with another molecule, it may lose its energy. So if we put it in a viscous solvent, very thick viscous solvent, like I can't remember what it's which phthalate it is. It's like a phenyl phthalate, diphenyl phthalate. Anyway, the phthalate. What's a phthalate? A phthalate is a benzene ring with two carboxylic acid type groups coming off of it, right? That would be phthalic acid. If I take the carboxylic acid and make esters out of them and put some other R group on there, I now have a organic phthalate. So you get this very, it is very viscous. Putting that as a solvent prevents the molecules from colliding with one another and deactivating the luminescence. In the molecule, I put a dye, in this case a red dye, but a lot of times it's the green dye. You know, you see everybody with the green light sticks. They make blue ones too, but the green is the most efficient. You put a dye in there. It's a fluorescent dye. Now, that has to get energy from somewhere. We're not doing photoluminescence anymore. We're not shining light on things. We're going to do chemistry. So I want to get a molecule that when that undergoes a chemical reaction that transfers its energy to the dye. So I have what's used in here is an ester. I don't remember the molecule, but it's an ester and a peroxide. You put peroxide, you mix it with the ester, it cleaves the bond, creates energy that's transferred to the dye and causes the dye to glow. So it's four components in the system. The reason you have to break it, there's a glass ampoule inside. Okay, there's a glass tube, right? So you've got this big plastic tube, and inside is a glass ampoule. Inside of that glass ampoule is 100% hydrogen peroxide. Dangerous stuff. It's inside of there. Dangerous. First of all, it could burn you pretty seriously, right? The stuff you buy in the grocery, in the pharmacy, hydrogen peroxide, that's 3%. That's 100%. The stuff you buy we have some in the refrigerator downstairs. Every time I work with it, that's 30%. Every time I work with it, I burn my hands. You get a little bit of it on your hands, turns your skin white, it yellowish kind of, it just oxidizes your skin. Well, 100% hydrogen peroxide is what the Germans used. They experimented with it as an oxygen source for in submarines so that the people could breathe, right? They stored 100% hydrogen peroxide. Turns out it explodes. They blew up a few submarines that way. Okay. Okay. So I got four components in there. I got a viscous solvent, a dye, an ester, and then an oxidizing agent, which is peroxide. The chemical reaction causes energy transfer to a dye, which creates an excited state, which luminesces, gives off light. That's chemiluminescence. You can use that for analytical applications. There are analytical applications of chemiluminescence. You go down to the fluorescence instrument, you put your cuvette in, you don't even turn the source on. You leave the source turned off. You turn the instrument on so the detector is working and the monochrometer is working. You put something in your cuvette that will undergo chemiluminescence. Maybe you put in, you know, the dye or whatever, and you add some peroxide to it, shake it up, put it in the cuvette, and you can measure, record a spectrum. You can record the emission spectrum of the substance based on the chemiluminescence. If you go to if you're into the internet, there's a video on YouTube of somebody taking Mountain Dew and mixing peroxide with it. Now, did you try it?
No.
Okay, I think it's a hoax. I don't think it's real. Somebody's just being funny. They said, oh, look, we can do this, and everybody's out there trying, it doesn't work.
But I hear that the Mountain Dew can do in the dark.
Well, that's what it's all about. That's what the video's all about. I think it's a hoax, but you should try it. Okay, you should try it and see. Okay? If it works, tell me. The reason I think it's a hoax is because they use 100% hydrogen peroxide in here because traces of water quench the reaction. Well, Mountain Dew is made with water, so it's got a lot of water in it.
No, but they use the yellow pipe or yellow something as a compound, so it might be as a dye.
Yeah.
It can be excited.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem. The dye is fine. I wouldn't be surprised if the dye could be made to glow. But the question is, can you add hydrogen peroxide, which is what they do. The YouTube video says a guy taking Mountain Dew, just a little bit in the bottom of a bottle, puts in some baking soda, what, buffer the pH? I don't know. Adds a few capfuls of 3% hydrogen peroxide, shakes it up, and the thing glows in the dark green. Okay? The problem is that the peroxide oxidation of the sugar that's in the Mountain Dew or whatever, that reaction is quenched by water, and there's lots of water in there, so it might work. Okay, it probably is not as efficient as a light stick. You know, these last for hours. The Mountain Dew thing will probably last for minutes, but try it, see if it works. Okay, but it's chemiluminescence. Okay, it's chemical energy giving us light. Now, I told you photoluminescence was phosphorescence and fluorescence. Chemiluminescence or bioluminescence was biological energy to create the excited state. Then we got chemiluminescence, which is chemical energy to create the excited state. We're not done. We got triboluminescence, which is mechanical energy. So you can create an excited state mechanically. Example. This often people take hard candy and they chew it, they bite it, breaking the crystal structure of the sugar, sucrose, glucose, whatever, causes a flash of light, causes triboluminescence. They say, I've seen it done actually, I've done it myself, take some hard candy, go into the bathroom, turn the lights off, stand in front of the mirror, and chew the candy with your mouth open. And you'll see little flashes of green light. That's the triboluminescence of the glucose or sucrose or whatever sugar is in that candy. Okay. You can also do it with Band-Aids. These Curad Band-Aids that look like this. Band-Aid looks like this. Two pieces of paper glued together, and you peel it apart to get the Band-Aid out. Well, the Band-Aid is glued together with a rubber cement that undergoes triboluminescence. I discovered this myself. You peel the Band-Aid. I discovered it 25 years ago. I had a cut in my finger, and I was it was bleeding at night. I was sleeping, and I woke up, and my hand was bleeding. I had a cut already, but it had stopped bleeding, so I thought it was okay. And then I woke up in the middle of the night, and it was bleeding. So I got a Band-Aid, and I opened it up, and it in the dark, and it glowed. Very, very faint glow. Right where the two pieces of paper are glued together. So the mechanical energy of pulling the glue apart gives off triboluminescence. Okay, this is mechanical energy converted to light. And it's not static electricity because it works underwater. Okay? Anyway. Then there's electroluminescence. You apply electrical energy to cause the excited state and get luminescence. Some polymers do this, and the polymer people talk about electroluminescence because they're all interested in making polymer organic semiconductors or things that conduct under some conditions, don't conduct under others, apply a potential to them, and cause them to shift from a non-conductive to a conductive state. Well, this would all be part of electroluminescence process. There's a joke. It's like the Band-Aids and the candy and all that other stuff. And the Mountain Dew is the electric pickle. You take a pickle, get a big pickle, put two nails, any metal in the end of it, and apply electricity to it. The one I saw was in Chemical Engineering News. The guy would plug it. He took a extension cord, cut the wires, connected the wires to the two ends of the pickle and plugged it into the outlet, and the pickle glows green. It could be dangerous, okay, playing with electricity, but But they claim this is electroluminescence. It glows because of excited states formed by electrical power. Okay. Photoluminescence is useful, right? Phosphorescence, fluorescence is a useful phenomenon because many compounds exist that exhibit this phenomenon. We can use it for analytical chemistry. The effect can be readily produced. I can put it in an instrument. I can shine a light on it. I can control it. I have several variables that I can use to control the process. I can change the excitation wavelength of light. I can change the emission. I can look at different wavelengths of emission with my monochromator. I can pulse the light, modulate, pulse the light, use a synchronizing detector. So phosphorescence and fluorescence are good analytical tools, controlled luminescence processes. Chemiluminescence is a little bit harder to control because you got to mix some chemical reagents and then look for the luminescence, but still useful. Bioluminescence is not useful to a chemist, okay, and not useful for analytical purposes. Triboluminescence and electroluminescence, just curiosities, okay, just for me to get across to you the idea that you can all you need to do is get an excited state, and then you can emit radiation as luminescence. Okay, we're going to study the next time the Jablonski energy level diagram, but I'm going to quit right there for today. And you do need to desperately need to.